WRN USA Radio News.
Once there was a civilization, much like ours, but with a greater intelligence, greater powers, and a greater capacity for good.
Even though you've been raised as a human being, you are not one of them. For good. I have sent them you, my only son.
Welcome back to the Light of Day, coming to you on Orion Talk Radio Network. Well, I enjoyed the interview we just had with John Moore. I have Gilbert Erickson on the line now, and we're going to be getting back into Wormwood Science 101. And we'll be talking about a few things. Hello, Gilbert. Welcome to the Light of Day.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Okay. What do you think about some of these emails I've been sending to you from these people that, you know, say this and that, and the Wormwood just ain't out there?
Oh, you mean like this character David, who keeps trying to pound on issues?
Yeah, David or Mike in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Did you want a quick thumbnail review of the physical evidence, or what?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
All right. One of the problems that we have is that 60% of the stars in the nearby in our sector of space, our galaxy, are at least 60%, 60% plus, are known to be binary stars. Some are actually complexes, triplicates of binaries or so forth. That's the first problem. It seems to be something has to do with the way stars are formed, how solar systems are formed. Okay, the inclination of the Earth, it has a particular axis, rotational axis, and that axis is canted over at 23.45 degrees. Number three, the evidence of the perturbation, from the perturbation of the planets, whereas the planets are deflected from their normal orbits, that evidence goes back to 1821 with astronomer Alexis Bouvard, where he noticed that the planet Uranus was deflected out of its normal orbital pattern when it was over on the side of the solar system corresponding to the June solstice of the Earth. If you take the June solstice line from the center of the sun through the center of the Earth at June 21 and extend it out the rest of the solar system, the planets on that side had deflections in them. They were not in their correct places. And because the orbits of the planets like Uranus and Neptune were nearly perfect circles, any deflection from their normal orbital pattern was fairly easy to pick up. So he had hard physical evidence that something was different on that side of the solar system. And then, in addition, there's been a long litany of investigators who have come to the conclusion that the physical presentation of the surface features of planet Earth are not the product of uniformitarian slow drag behavior, but in fact are probably driven much more by catastrophism than anything else. Okay? Evidence, for example, that there was huge weight at one time on what is now Brazil. Evidence that at one time there was a fairly huge weight on what is now South Africa. And the same thing for a large section of Canada. In other words, basically, the South Pole at one time was located in Brazil. At another time, it was located in South Africa. At another time, it was located, the North Pole was located over Canada. And the lower end of the ice sheet for the North Pole was right where the Missouri River is located in the United States now. And it goes on and on and on like that. The tectonic shifting and pulling and tearing and volcanism at the edges and so forth. There's just an awful lot of evidence for catastrophic intervention in the surface features that are generated here on planet Earth. So by the time you shake it all down, there's physical evidence that something from time to time catastrophically shakes things up at the very least and causes changes in surface features here on the Earth. So that combination of evidence ingredients, if you would, tends to suggest that there's something heavy quite capable of doing all of this. Now the question is what?
What are your thoughts about this Huffington Post article that John Moore shared?
Well, it's rather intriguing that Huffington is willing to include that information, for public consumption at this time. Now, I don't think they had it online, but it was in the article that if you downloaded it for print, they had it was just a little tiny blurb. Was it down almost near the end of the article? Not quite at the end. And why would they do it now? Are they the trial balloon to start floating this idea gently to the public, or what's going on? Because most of the major media have, sort of dropped this with a, like a hot potato since, 1983. There hasn't been anything published on Planet X or Wormwood or anything like that. Now all of a sudden here it comes again. One other thing, I'm not the only one who's into this Planet X Wormwood thing. There are others, certainly, much more competent researchers, even astronomers that are into it. Now, there's some disagreements on some of the details, but there's some very good people who are quite bothered by the problems that are presented both in the solar system and by the geology here on planet Earth. So by the time you add, all of this up, you don't have to be, a peripheral nutcase to be interested. I think it's Professor, John Matisse, University of Louisiana, has been saying this for several years now, that there's something out there that's headed this way, and it causes a lot of grief when it comes through the local neighborhood. So, there are some sources of people who think that the Planet X problem is definitely something real, does need to be dealt with, and does need to be planned for. Of course, Dr. Robert Harrington was one of those astrophysicists who worked for, U.S. Observatory? Naval Observatory. So, there have been some very bright people, and there are some very bright people who are saying that this thing is coming, and we need to start, looking, and we need to start preparing.
We'll just briefly go over this email here from somebody not agreeing with you. He says, Gilbert says it's made of iron and unusually heavy, so the gravitational pull would take our solar system apart long before it gets here. Many thousands of amateur astronomers would see the gravitational effects of this object. They would also very likely find the object. Amateurs' telescopes can observe asteroids that are as small as a few tens of kilometers across, so there's no way that they would miss a planet or whatever that is only 2 years away from hitting us, and there's no way to keep many thousands of amateur astronomers from all over the world quiet. So what do you got to say to that?
Sir, our friend David.
Yeah.
Well, David, here's to you, bud. Sorry, I have to take you on this one. Okay, first off, the Planet X problem goes all the way back into the 1800s. Right? This is not a new or a novel problem. It started with the perturbations of the outer planets of the solar system, that the orbit of Uranus, which should have been a near-perfect circle on the June solstice side of Earth's orbital traverse, when Uranus got out to an extended line close to that, it started to have a dip in its orbit. That led to the discovery of Neptune. The problem was Neptune had the same problem. Then again in 1983, when the IRIS, when the, well, 1982, the Pioneer satellites, and then 1983, the IRIS satellite was lofted to go searching for this thing in the infrared part of the spectrum. Again, those two planets were out near right ascension 18 at the point of near maximal deflection. So this has been an ongoing problem in astronomy to account for this anomaly that should not be there in what would normally be a regular, very predictable circular orbit. But it is there, and that's the first issue. Okay, David says that it's going to take up 20% of the nighttime sky right now. The answer to that is no. That's at its closest point. It would take up about a fifth of the sky. And the reference on that is the Colbrin Bible, sometimes just referred to as the Colbrin, K-O-L-B-R-I-N. And in there, I believe they comment that when it gets at its closest point, as it arcs over toward the, arcing over the sun on its perihelion maneuver, that it takes up a fifth of the nighttime sky. That's a pretty big object. Okay, that's large. So what we're having to do is basically piece together all these various pieces, parts of the puzzle, and try to make some kind of sense. What is it that would, add up with all these clues? What does it point to? And again, it points to a problem of some sort of heavy body. Now, the inside people that I was sourcing information from said that it would be very heavy, somewhere between Saturn and Jupiter size, possibly even larger than Jupiter. Mostly made of iron, iron sulfide, those kinds of things. Iron sulfide is fairly black, which is hard to see.
Hey, Gilbert.
And it would be, it would indeed be quite a heavy object. Go ahead.
Well, that was another thing. You said you had some inside black ops sources, but they weren't very forthcoming. Are these people from NASA or the astronomical community? Where are they from?
No, I don't want to say.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing as you. If you protect the people who feed you information, you follow?
Sure.
Then they continue to feed you information. If you blab on or rat out the people who feed you information, first off, they deny it, but then they never talk to you again.
Okay.
And why should they, really? Is it that you want to constantly be ratting out your sources and acting like a fool and then cutting yourself off from additional information? No.
Fair enough.
Okay. Sorry. if somebody's in the professional community, astronomy, NASA, government, National Science Foundation, Kavli Corporation, Case Western Reserve University, University of Chicago, Office of Polar Operations, Raytheon, any of those people, if they wanted to talk and they wanted it to be off the record, then I'd want them to feel free to talk. And it would stay off the record. If they say they want their names off the record, fine. That's how it stays. And that's how it should be. When people are afraid of what's going on, current power structure, current political environment, they can't be faulted for being cautious. That's reality. That's the way it is.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Hey, well, me and you were exchanging some emails there about how Wormwood might be exerting some tugging on this undersea oil volcano out in the Gulf. How convinced are you that Wormwood is actually tugging at that thing?
It would be, but it would be tugging sort of in the other direction. Remember, the orbital pattern of Wormwood is a long ellipsoid pattern, really long. For people who want to get a view of it, they should go and look at the CG model that we have on the website, millenniumprophecy.com, and look at the gallery page, and you'll see a blue trace line for the orbit. It's a very, very long ellipsoid orbit. you figure about 3,660 years of transit time, plus or minus. You know, that's just most of the pull then that it exerts on its inbound approach or on its outbound departure will be from the southern side. It probably spends, I don't know, maybe 3.5 years up above on the top side, northern side of the ecliptic plane. So it's going to be pulling from the southern side. But what it's doing is its axis of rotation will be perpendicular to that ellipsoid orbit. And that means that its rotating action, the rotating point at its equator, will be coplanar, the same plane as that ellipsoid orbit, which means it's at 90 degrees to the activity, gravitational, you know, orbit pattern, EM patterns of the sun. So here comes something that's pulling on us from the southern side and pelting us, if you would, beating up on us with a rotating EM field. It should be pulling mostly from on the southern side of the hemisphere. Now remember, we're cocked over about 23.45 degrees, but it still should be pulling mostly from the southern side of the hemisphere. But at the same time, it is rotating like a giant disk with this gravitational and EM field. And as it does this, it is massaging, if you would, the iron and iron compounds and paramagnetic compounds, copper, aluminum, and so forth, in the mantle of the Earth and in the lithosphere of the Earth. So the electromagnetism is basically kind of massaging, if you would, the mantle immediately under the tectonic plates. And that's not quite liquid. It's more like Play-Doh. It's malleable. So when you have this constantly rotating, moving field, it can heat that up and cause distortions, push stuff over on one side, pull it on the other, you know, make it move around where it normally would just sit still as frozen plastic. But instead, it's getting hotter and, you know, pushing and pulling and tugging and bulging and doing things that it wouldn't do. So very possibly, you know, that email that you mentioned, that someone had said the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico was rising. Well, if that's true, what would be the mechanism that would make it do that? It has to be something that is lifting the entire seafloor up. What would that be? Then BP and the others go out there drilling, and they find out there's very, very high head pressures underneath. When they get down about 30,000 feet, it's really pushing, which it would be anyway at 30,000 feet. It's very high head pressures. But if the mantle was underneath pushing in addition to that, there would be additional pressure. This is probably a good reason to go drilling out there because you get more oil as a freebie.
I can't remember if it's the steam or the pressure or whatever, but it's up to 100,000 PSI down there.
Well, that's the claim. I'm not sure if it's that high. You'd have to check your, you know, petroleum records on that to see how high it is. I don't think it's I know there are some people that have said that, but I'm not sure if it's that high. That does need to be checked, that figure. And it will vary from field to field. They're not all the same, so, you know.
I see.
Yeah. They can. Some of them have more pressure than others. Some have a larger gas cap than others and so on.
Well, Richard Hoagland was one of these folks that put that figure out there, 100,000.
Yeah, that would be one I'd want to check. It's possible, but then see, as it rises, the pressure dissipates, and as it blows off more and more oil, the pressure dissipates. You know, you have column height. You have to subtract the column height that it pushes up, that 30,000 feet of column height. You have to take that away. And then as the pressure, you know, as more and more oil blows out into the ocean, you're going to be relieving the pressure down below slightly until the field hits the neutral point that it can't push the column of oil up anymore, and then it would stop flowing.
Well, that was another thing Richard Hoagland mentioned, was that as this stuff's coming out, it's creating a cavitation process there, whereby this humongous gas bubble is developing. Did you read that?
I'm going to have problems with some of that. Some of the gases can be entrained in the water. But eventually, you know, as the water circulates and, you know, the colder waters eventually make it to the up near the surface, then as the water temperature rises, in which the gases are entrained, they will come back out of solution, if you will. They will disassociate to normalize for any given pressure and temperature. You know, this is the Boyle's Law and Charles' Law, gas laws. So the methane that makes it to the surface will also slowly rise to the higher altitudes, way up above the higher altitudes of the ionosphere. And eventually it wisps off into space itself, because the gravitational pull of the Earth isn't strong enough to hold on to it. So very slowly methane rises. It takes some time, but it does get to the upper reaches of the atmosphere, and then the Earth actually loses its grip on it, and the methane gas is lost into space. That doesn't matter what the source is. It could be coming from a pipe like natural gas. It could be coming out of a cow's ass. It can be coming out of, pick a spot where methane comes from, and ants or termites or whatever, and any source for methane gas, the same thing would be true. Very slowly it does migrate to the higher reaches of the atmosphere, and then it's dissipated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. I also seen in your email you sent me a sky chart here, and you mentioned that as we come in on to the date of June 21st, that Wormwood could somehow interact with the Earth. Can you elaborate more on that, please?
Well, no. We can divide the solar system into, split it in half, or in quarters, if you like. We would use the solstice line, center of the sun to the center of the Earth, at the June 21st orbital position. And we would use the solstice line from the center of the sun to the center of the Earth at the December 21st orbital position. And then we would take those two lines and we would extend them out through the rest of the solar system, all the way out past Neptune and Pluto. And it gives us kind of a reference, if you would. And that reference lets us kind of orient ourselves based on the orbital year of the Earth, where the Earth is during the months of the year. The perturbations of the planets were happening over on the right ascension 18 side, which corresponds to this June solstice line extended out. That's where that kind of activity was seen. So as we approach that line, that's the line, if you would, where this cutting blade action is going to be most intense as Wormwood approaches, getting closer and closer to the ecliptic plane. It's kind of like a giant table saw. I think I mentioned this on your show before, that you've got a giant table saw with a set of concentric rings on it. You can crank the handle and it comes right up through the slot in the table. Well, the table of the table saw would be the ecliptic plane. And the plane of the blade would be the plane of Wormwood's rotating field.
Hold that thought, Gilbert. We're at the bottom of the hour break. Hey, this is fun. We'll be back in a few minutes with our special returning guest, Gilbert Erickson. You're listening to The Light of Day on Orion Talk Radio Network. Stay tuned, folks.
Free speech guaranteed. You're listening to the Orion Talk Radio Network. The Orion Talk Radio Network is here. The First Amendment of the Constitution grants us freedom of speech. That's the freedom to express our views and opinions without censorship. If you listen to mainstream radio at all, you'll notice that free speech is pretty hard to find these days, with just a handful of networks offering programs that dare to discuss topics and issues that have a profound impact on our daily lives. The mainstream media simply lies by omission and distortion of the facts. The Orion Talk Radio Network is committed to bringing you entertaining and thought-provoking programming that dares to tell the truth. And you can help us as we grow our network. If you think you have what it takes to host a show, you know of someone interested in hosting a show, or any other suggestions, comments, or questions, please drop us an email at OrionTalkRadio@gmail.com. That's OrionTalkRadio@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to the Orion Talk Radio Network.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the Light of Day, coming to you on Orion Talk Radio Network. We're live Saturday night, June 19th. We have our returning guest, Gilbert Erickson, on the line, and he was describing this this table saw cutting blade that that's the way Planet X acts, as it pierces our ecliptic plane. Anyway, Gilbert, welcome back.
Okay, good to be back. Let's see, where were we? We wanted to deal with some of the stuff from your email correspondent, David, or do you want me to continue with the description? What do you want to do?
Yeah, if you'd continue your thought there on that table cutting saw action, I'd like to hear mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, on the website we have an animation, but for the radio audience, I mean, and you can go there, you know, millenniumprophecy.com is the website, and it shows roughly what we think it would look. It's a CG, but it shows roughly what we think the movement, the action would be for Planet X. So just go to the website and click the animation button. You can watch it. You can also watch it full screen.
Hey, Gilbert.
But to describe it verbally, it is. It's more like cranking up the blade on a table saw that kind of emerges up through the slot while it's running, and then you can crank it back down, and it, you know, it recedes back down into the slot. That's kind of the action, I guess, we'd want to describe, you know, verbally for the radio audience. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you there. I had another thought come to my mind. I was re-listening to your interview you did with George Noy from June of last year, and you said that there were these, like, five or six events that would come out of the sixth seal, and if they didn't happen by the end of last year, that they would happen, like, before the end of next month. Do you still
well,
see that?
Yeah, I did miss my first two estimates on timing, and I'll have to own up to that and you know, tell a radio audience that's true. In other words, I guessed, but without tracking data, that's kind of a, you know, that's not a good approach. That's a bad approach. But I took the best guesses I could guess without getting my hands on hard data. But hard data is classified right now. You can't get your hands on that unless you are particularly connected in a certain way. And not everybody inside government can do it. You follow?
Sure.
So I don't want to be doing that anymore. But the list of events that I listed were the sixth seal events. And the pattern pressure that I was looking at the time suggested to me that there was the possibility that could be an imminent event set that could be happening. As we know now, we have a little bit more time. The question is still, how much more? We don't know how much more. But for those who are interested and would like to read about the sixth seal event list, just go to millenniumprophecy.com and click on the sixth seal event list, and it describes what they are. It gives you know, the same stuff that I covered on the show with George Norrie, but there's a list of them, and they refer to the list of events that are covered in Revelation 6, verse 12 through 14. And I outlined very specifically what I think those verses mean in terms of what will happen as wormwood events. And when this set of events erupts, then it means that these very harsh, judgmental things that are described in Revelation 8 are not far behind. They're very shortly, you know, they will happen very shortly after that. So you get a little bit of a heads up, and I wanted the listening audience to know about those. Anyway, millenniumprophecy.com, sixth seal, gives that list of seven things to be looking for.
Now,
want to cover those, go over those again? Or?
Yeah, could you? I don't think I've heard you actually mention those on our past interviews.
Oh, that, you know what? We never did we?
No, I don't think we have.
Okay. Yeah, let's go over that. I'll just give a quick thumbnail sketch. For those of you who are wondering where this came from, this comes from the Revelation chapter 6. In my opinion, the chapter 6 events that are listed are like a heads up or a set of road signs, if you will, that the judgments are coming and the removal of the Christian church is not far behind. So from Revelation 6:12-14, I looked when he broke the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth made of hair. The whole moon became like blood. The stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe grapes, figs, when shaken by a great wind. The sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island removed out of their places. Okay, so then we went over the list. Okay, great earthquake. I think that what happens is one of these node rings that we describe on the website hits the earth fairly close, not maybe dead center, but fairly close to dead center on either the December side or the June side of its orbital position. So one of the node rings gets very close to us, and we have massive tectonic shaking lasting 10, maybe 20 minutes, maybe even more. We don't know. But there's a lot of destruction that happens. The sun becomes black as sackcloth made of hair. That tells us that we're going to get a lot of volcanic activity, especially at tectonic plate edges, like the Rim of Fire, that eject high tonnages of ash into the upper atmosphere, like that one up in Iceland is doing, only much worse. And again, this would be black hair for Middle Eastern people, not blonde hair. Okay, the whole moon became like blood. This is where wormwood throws fairly large tonnages of iron oxide dust and debris between the Earth and the moon and into Earth's atmosphere. And when we look through the veil, if you would, of this massive tonnage of fine iron oxide dust, it looks like the moon takes on a near blood red color. It's a kind of a bizarre thing to, it's like a filter over the moon, a curtain of dust, and it colors, changes the color of the moon. The stars of the sky fell to the earth. It throws asteroids, various forms of space junk, little pieces of comet, meteorites, this, that, and the other. The sky was split apart like a scroll. And that was number four. And then number five, the sky was split apart like a scroll, but then it says when it is rolled up. And the way that I would interpret that, that John was experiencing something like a pyroclastic explosion similar to Mount St. Helens, where you get a massive blast that feels like the sky is splitting apart. And then as he looked up, he saw this mushroom cloud that he just did not know how to relate to at all. But it looked very much like a scroll that when you spread it out and you release it, it rolls back up. Anybody who's ever dealt with blueprints that have been rolled up knows what that's like. You let them go, they spring back. And that's what he's describing. So if he was looking up at a mushroom cloud from underneath in his vision, and he looked at that behavior, that tucking action, his descriptor is actually very accurate. It's just he's using a first century analog, something that, you know, we wouldn't expect him to do, but it describes very accurately, mushroom cloud. And then I said, let's see, there was one more. Every mountain and island were moved out of their places, number six. That the tectonic shifting from the wormwood node ring earthquake and stuff, it will shift the mountains and islands to different places, okay, shift them out of their current positions. An example of that was the 2004 tsunami down by Indonesia. When that happened, the island of Sumatra shook for 10 minutes, a 9.0 earthquake, and it just rolled and heaved and shook and rolled and rolled and rolled, and it didn't stop. This went on for 10 minutes, and then the tsunami triggered. When they measured later to get a location of the fix of Sumatra's position, it had moved 110 feet from its former position.
Hey, Gilbert?
Let me finish.
Okay, go ahead.
110 feet, and that's why the tsunami was so deadly. That was a major tectonic shift that would trigger a tsunami in the waters above. You follow?
Yeah.
So then I threw in the seventh one as a freebie that's not listed. I said, well, if we're going to get this kind of islands and stuff shifting around, then you should probably expect, you know, coastal invasions, tsunami events. So there were seven different things there that were listed. And that's, again, that's all on the Millennium Prophecy, the sixth seal. Just click on that button. There's the list. It's right there. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to interject there on that sixth item you mentioned. I was listening to David Sarita. He was on Coast to Coast back on June 2nd, and you know, he mentioned this, and I remember what you had said on George Norrie's show. David Sarita said that he also thinks that tsunami at the end of 2004 was triggered by some massive solar event, and as me and you know, Wormwood is probably affecting the sun already, so that could be another dot connector right there.
Yeah, I would expect it to get much worse. For those of you who are serious students of Revelation prophecy, you would want to start associating or connecting that dot with chapter 16, which is a second set of Wormwood events. And in that list, in Revelation 16, one of the things that it comments about is that the angel pours out his bowl of wrath on the sun, and the sun is actually able to scorch the earth like it's being scorched with fire. Okay? It's a sort of a strange description, but the dialogue, if you would, or the interaction between Wormwood and the sun, there has to be something going on because you got two highly charged bodies, but they're cutting at each other at 90 degrees. So there's bound to be some sort of crazy crosstalk or electromagnetic gravitic interaction or something going on. And evidently, Wormwood is able to trigger a nasty, nasty set of solar, unleashings, if you would, of CME events or something so bad that it just raises the surface temperatures here on Earth to nearly unbearable. You can't stay out in the sun. You've got to find shade. And that list is in Revelation 16 for those who are interested in. And that one is rough. So when that Wormwood triggers its second set of Wormwood-related judgments, Chapter 16 describes practically the destruction of civilization here on Earth as we know it. It's really bad. Go ahead.
Well, I listened to Professor McCanny's show from two nights ago, and he's actually finally admitting that this finally pick up on activity since June 11th, and here we've had this major warning put out by NASA here about 5 or 6 days ago. It was picked up on the Drudge Report on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. The Weather Channel was carrying it on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So you think they're trying to warn us that really could be associated with Wormwood's incoming passage?
Yes and no. Michio Kaku was on, and Dr. Kaku, Professor Kaku, explained that they had underestimated what the next set of solar cycle activities, the intensity that it might deliver. And he said there was the strange, sneaky suspicion that this next go-around of the, you know, the so-called 11-year period of the sun's next cycle was going to be a lot rougher than it had been before. And, you know, there's times in the past, like, again, the mid-1800s, when the solar cycle was enough to trigger these crazy charge-ups of the telegraph system. You remember that? It'd start fires in the telegraph offices, start fires in the paper, and they could shut off the batteries and still send messages. I mean, there's some pretty strange things were happening. And that's because of that huge electric plasma charge that the sun gives off during this period. So he has claimed that they may be underestimated. This life will be a lot worse. Does it have to be associated with Wormwood? That's not what they're saying. They're just saying that, you know, expect that the solar activity could be a lot worse than what it has been, which is correct. The only problem is when you've got Wormwood in the neighborhood doing the kinds of crazy things it does and the sun getting ready for a newly active cycle, that's a bad combination. I mean, that's like a perfect storm, but in the wrong direction. Very destructive. You follow?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the Wormwood activity could just exacerbate or make a bad situation much worse. And that's entirely possible. But they haven't admitted that there's any Wormwood interplay yet. That'll come later.
Yeah, you know, when we're dealing with objects out in space, it's so hard to prove things because, you know, the sun could be just undergoing its own thing. You just never know.
Well, the fact that it's happened before tends to suggest that the sun is vulnerable and that the plasma activities of the sun might indeed be a great deal more, flexible than what we give it credit for. It's not the calm, quiet, sedate star that everybody would like to believe. Sometimes it gets a little rough. One physicist commented that if the sun were to release a really major, big-time major CME that hit the Earth dead center in the face, it is possible that the sun could throw enough energy to boil the oceans of the Earth.
Wow.
Now, that's a big CME. In fact, in Revelation 16, it talks about the kingdom of the beast being darkened. And if you have this massive thing from the fourth judgment there, it talks about pouring his bowl of wrath out on the sun, and the sun is given to scorch men with fire, then the sun is revved up by this plasma interaction going on between wormwood and the sun, and the earth catches one right in the face. And the amount of energy is so intense that it does, you know, evaporate large amounts of water from the oceans and the lakes and streams massively, big time, majorly. And it is so intense that the entire planet clouds over and goes black down at the surface. Now, that's a heavy cloud cover. You follow?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if the Earth gets hit with a major CME, and it just turns out that Wormwood happens to be able to trigger something like that, we could be on the receiving end of some very, very bad news. That's not good news. That's bad news.
Even
if... Because it's enough to boil the oceans if it gets really revved up. Now, it might not be that heavy, but it's certainly enough to raise, you know, billions of tons of water vapor into the air until you get a cloud cover covering the entire planet. And we're not the blue planet anymore. Suddenly, we're the white planet with all the cloud cover. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, even if we found out in the end that this was all a psyops and Wormwood wasn't going past us, they're trying to hint to us that there could be some very cataclysmic solar storm headed our way. The point is, we need to get prepared, folks.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's going to get rough.
I mean, they even show it at the end of the movie Knowing. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Now, I rented from Blockbuster here tonight this 2012 movie. I'm really excited to watch it tomorrow. Have you seen that one?
Yes.
Do they show anything about the solar scorching in there?
Not really. What he does is he takes a different tack altogether. Roland Emmerich used the Wormwood card, so to speak, or at least hinted at it with the movie Impact. But then with 2012, he took a different tack, and the tack was that there was this massive upping of the neutrino activity of the sun. And the neutrino activity of the sun was penetrating the Earth and heating up the Earth's core, and causing instabilities by, you know, indirectly by doing it that way. And then, of course, the result is a tectonic shifting and slap and slide and these massive ocean waves and all this other stuff and huge volcanic activity. That's the approach that he used this time. The approach, and to my mind, it's just a little bit flaky. It doesn't quite jive with some of the biblical data that we have describing these events, but it's, you know, it makes a great movie. The point is that the stuff that can be done and the stuff that is done, at least you get a description of some of the weirdness that can happen, and, you know, at least part of that, that's good. The science behind it is maybe a little bit disconnected, but you got to understand these guys are in the movie business. And their job is to part you from, you know, the money in your pocketbook there, or in your purse or whatever, and, you know, that's what they're after. So they have to put on quite a show for you to, you know, want to come in and see it.
Sure. Hey, another quick question. I got to looking into what Scorpio and Sagittarius look like in the night sky. You said if I go out at midnight, and how far up do I have to look to find Scorpio and Sagittarius? Is it about 45 degrees up, or how far up would that be?
Not quite that far. It's out there on the you know, zodiac horizon. So it's up off of the horizon. But you just look to the southern sky. Do you have any clear weather to work with in your area?
Oh, yeah, the vast majority of the time when we got these clear desert skies down here.
You're in Tucson, right?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent place to do that. Just look toward the south. And if you can remember the shape of the scorpion, this, you know, the scorpion's tail, that's kind of a big constellation. And then Sagittarius is to the left of it, looks kind of like a teapot. And just pick out those two constellations. And when they're in, you have to see that imaginary line that runs, you know, vertically down between them when they're in the correct vertical position. Because right ascension 18 is just barely off the tip of the spout of the teapot of Sagittarius, between Sagittarius and Scorpius. So just look to the southern sky, and you'll see it. First you want to look for the scorpion's tail, and then Sagittarius on the left side, and right ascension 18 is between them. But in order to see Wormwood, you'd have to be located over on the southern hemisphere side of the planet. The problem is you're still in Tucson, you're still up in the northern hemisphere side. So you've got to get over down past the equator. You're still a little bit too far north.
Okay. Hey, have you shared any of this information with Professor McCanny? Because he doesn't believe that there's a single Planet X inbound incoming object out there right now. Have you shared any of this with him?
This has been publicly available since you and George Norrie have been willing to do these interviews, plus the book and plus the website on the internet. So I don't know if Jim has bothered to check it out, but it's certainly there if he wants to look at it. I haven't pushed it on him, you know, or approached him in any way.
Cause
I'm kind of a Jim McCanny fan myself, because Professor McCanny is really quite bright, and he's a very good mathematician, and is a good commentator in many ways. But the Wormwood science, I think, that he was trying to fill in that revelation blank with was the comet thing. And that's how I started out, actually. It wasn't until I heard the description of Dr. Jason Rand with this Return of Planet X that he described two sets of interactive events, inbound and outbound. And I said, okay, now we've got, that's our breakthrough. Because that was the problem that I could see as a pervasive pattern in the revelation. You had the Chapter 8 events, and then you had the Chapter 16 events. Now, the drive mechanism was similar in both cases. But what was the thing that was the drive mechanism? Okay? These two sets of events separated in time, about 3.5 years between them. What was the drive mechanism? And that was the first time that ever came about. Then a little bit of additional information, and then I started filling in that blank, you know, on the orbital patterns and how that works. And so I was able to rewrite the science and come up with this a little bit better view of what we think is about to happen.
Well, according to McCanny, the Earth used to be a comet at one time, and he also says that Venus was the last object to come past here to cause these great Earth cataclysms. Do you agree with him on those two points?
It's entirely possible. Venus is, of course, spinning backwards from the other planets and a number of other things, I think it is. I believe it's Venus. There is the possibility that these kinds of things could happen with a new plasma-based electromagnetic gravitic kind of node ring generation. It's entirely possible that that's how Venus was captured in its current orbit. I don't know. Emanuel Velikovsky, I believe, was the first one to describe that situation, that this is something that happened in ancient times, was described by ancient peoples, and the Mayan calendar is based on the Venusian annual treks, if you would. So I don't know if Jim is the first on that one, but That's a possibility. There's our solar system's past history may not be the benign, you know, day after day consistent patterns that we've seen in more recent years. It may not have been that way at all. Might have been quite a bit of upheaval. And there are those who make that case. Eric Von Daniken was one of them.
Well, there's the end of the show, Gilbert. I really thank you for coming on board tonight. Please go to Millennium Hospital. What is it again, Gilbert?
MillenniumProphecy.com.
Yeah, there it is, folks. So thanks for coming on board, Gilbert. We'll talk again sometime soon.
Keep the emails coming.
Will do. Thanks for yours as well.
You betcha.
Yep. Later.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, that's the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed Gilbert Erickson. Be back next weekend, same time, same Planet X channel. Later and out. Bye.
Orion Talk Radio Network is here. The First Amendment of the Constitution grants us freedom of speech. That's the freedom to express our views and opinions without censorship. If you listen to mainstream radio at all, you'll notice that free speech is pretty hard to find these days, with just a handful of networks offering programs that dare to discuss topics and issues that have a profound impact on our daily lives. The mainstream media simply lies by omission and distortion of the facts. The Orion Talk Radio Network is committed to bringing you entertaining and thought-provoking programming that dares to tell the truth. And you can help us as we grow our network. If you think you have what it takes to host a show, you know of someone interested in hosting a show, or any other suggestions, comments, or questions, please drop us an email at OrionTalkRadio@gmail.com. That's OrionTalkRadio@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to the Orion Talk Radio Network. The Big Shot of the Milliwatt. This is Micro 1650 AM, Tonawanda, New York.